Hey guys, as he mentioned, my first name's Brant. I'm Brant Howell. I am a patent attorney. I've worked in Mississippi, and I do tech law, entertainment law, and intellectual property. And I was asked to come speak to you guys about this Real DVD settlement. And just as an initial matter, as we go along, if y'all have any questions, some of this stuff, there are some real technical procedural stuff. I'll try to kind of gloss over that as much as I can, but if you have a question about it, I'm happy to answer that, and we'll just kind of, you know, take those as we go.
And we're, by the way, we record this so other people can listen to it who couldn't make it, so we'll bring you a microphone, because otherwise it sounds like he's lost his mind and he's talking to himself. Well, that might be true, but...
Yeah. I can usually find it somewhere if I'm attached to my head, I guess. All right. This Real DVD case, best way to handle any kind of a lawsuit is just start off by looking at who's actually involved. The plaintiffs here are the DVD Copyright Control Association. I'll refer to them as DVDCCA, even though the acronym is a mouthful. And then several major motion picture studios. Basically, they're concerned about taking content off of DVDs and making copies of it. Then you've got your defendant, which is Real Network, Inc. And Real Networks, they develop products that deliver digital media to consumers, streaming content typically. So what's the problem? What Real did is they created a program called Real DVD, and what Real DVD would do is it would take material off of a DVD and save it to your hard drive for playback at some later time. They also were simultaneously developing this product called Facet. Facet's a DVD archiving machine. Basically, you put your DVD in, it'll make an electronic copy of it so you can play it back later without needing to find the DVD. Real felt, based on another case that had come out, that it would be okay for them to do this, and what they're doing is not strictly copyright infringement, so I honestly would have thought they would have been okay to do this as well. But DVDCCA had some problems with it. Now, the first question is, why are the motion picture groups involved in this? They're worried about DVD piracy. They're worried about if people were allowed to just take a DVD and make a copy, they could pass it to a friend, pass it around a dorm, whatever, and you'd have copyright infringement, which is probably true on a small scale. But the main plaintiff in this one is DVDCCA. Really, the Motion Picture Association, they're in this suit for very good legal reasons that are not terribly important. DVDCCA is really the main plaintiff here. CCA is kind of like the movie industry's version of RIA. They have a lot of the same responsibilities. Basically, what they own the license to what's called CSS. It's a standard content scrambling, stands for content scrambling system. It's the standard content scrambling system they use on all DVDs and all DVD players. And basically what it does is it puts a scrambling key on the head portion of the DVD, as I understand it, and then they scramble all the content on the DVD accordingly, and then whenever a DVD player plays it, it pulls that encryption key, uses it on the content, and then can play the DVD. The benefit of this is that if you tried to make a just general bit-by-bit copy of the DVD, the theory is that you would miss these keys and the DVD would be unreadable. When this system first came out, the industry apparently believed that it was uncrackable. It was cracked pretty shortly thereafter, so, you know, it happens. So the question is, why is CCA upset about this archiving machine? Every company that makes any kind of a legitimate DVD player has to get a license to use CSS technology. It's the standard, and the standard is owned and controlled by CCA. So Real went and actually got one of these licenses because they were going to be developing this DVD technology. And one of the issues in this case is DVDCCA said that Real was breaching that agreement. They signed it, they agreed to it, and that was, like I said, one of the big issues. So let's actually get to the lawsuit itself. Real filed suit asking the court to say, we're putting this product out, we want you to tell us it's legal, it's okay. CCA turned around and countersued saying, court, stop the sale of all these products, they're injuring us, quit this right now. Going through some various procedural wranglings, the suit ended up in the Federal District Court of the Northern District of California, also a mouthful. And that's, it was all combined. So when I say plaintiff versus defendant, those terms are kind of loose, but I feel they're the best way to refer to the parties. One of the other issues was, did this DVD archiving system violate the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, DMCA? One of the provisions in the DMCA is that you can't create technology that circumvents a copyright protection technology, which CSS is a copyright protection technology. It's supposed to prevent you from making copies. So the question is, and that was really the main issue in this case, is what is the archiving that Real is doing, is that circumventing a technology, or is that a reasonable extension on just reading it through their licensing agreement? The CSS algorithm, one of the things it requires is that the DVD be physically in the drive and locked while the DVD is being played. And the decryption keys must be read from the DVD. Now, the parties did a lot of arguing on this point. Real had a bunch of experts saying, well, that's an extra step. That's no longer necessary whenever you're making archive copies. And, of course, DVD CCA turned around and saying, well, yeah, if it's no longer necessary, then clearly you're circumventing a decryption technology. The court, in an initial ruling, and this case didn't go all the way to a final ruling because obviously there was a settlement, but the court came down on the side of DVD CCA, and they said that if you're saving a content to a hard drive, it doesn't require keys anymore and doesn't require the DVD to be held in the drive, then clearly you're circumventing some kind of the CSS technology. So the court basically said this was a violation of Digital Millennium Copyright Act, so kind of a copyright violation if you want to put it that way. Another issue that came up in the course of this case, ArcOS and RipGuard. Certain of the movie industry groups, like I know Disney in particular, I think they were using RipGuard, but certain of the companies use ArcOS and RipGuard. And basically what these programs effectively do is when they're writing a DVD, they put bad sectors on the hard drive, or they'll put false information, on the DVD, and they'll put false information on the DVD. So a standard DVD player is going to read through that DVD, and it's going to play the content. It's going to ignore the bad sectors because they're in odd spots. However, if you're using a standard bit-by-bit copy, it's going to pick up those bad spots. And if you are just going through there, you can either it'll either slow down playback time, slow down copy time, or for the ones that actually have bad data, sometimes they'll hide menus in there that don't actually do anything, so it just kind of gums the equipment up. Real DVD's Facet player, they developed an algorithm for it that would find and avoid these bad sectors. It was supposed to act like a viewing person and not like a true computer. They spent about a year and a half working on this. And the question was, is this program attempting to view like a human and go around these bad sectors, is that a violation of Digital Millennium Copyright Act? And the court ruled that it was, that going around these things was another attempt to circumvent valid copyright protection. And I really don't know that I agree with this one in particular. So, in response to these rulings, the defendant in this case was able to raise the fair use defense. So the question is, does that get them around their violations of the DMCA? Traditionally, under the Sony v. Betamax case, happened way back years ago, it had to do with pulling content off of TV and recording it to a VHS tape. The court ruled that that was a time shift and that was a legitimate means of doing this, of making copies, and because you were allowed to view it in the first place, so you're just viewing it later in time. And that was the first defense that Real used in this case. Basically, the court ruled in this case that this time shifting, yes, it applies to general copyright infringement, but it doesn't apply to the DMCA in that way, because we're talking about not copyright infringement, but about circumventing copyright protections, which don't apply when you're recording a broadcast like that. And the court ruled, and I really think this logic is bad, but the court ruled that it's okay for people to make copies of their stuff, but it's not okay for companies to make software that allow them to do that. And the court specifically spelled this out. Well, and that's the problem. The court basically said that looking at the statute, it's a bad statute. Congress gave the public a right, but they didn't give the public the ability to exercise that right. Yes, sir.
So if I wrote the software myself, it's okay?
If you wrote the software yourself, it might be okay as long as you didn't distribute it to anyone else. As soon as you distributed it to anyone else, or if you used it for anything you didn't own, then it would not be okay.
My understanding is DMCA says I'm not even allowed to own the tools.
The court said that you were allowed to create the tools yourself. And whether, no matter what the DMCA says specifically, that's what this court said, was that you could make your own copies if you were tech-savvy enough to do it, but you couldn't create a software that the general public could use. I think this is a horrible logic, again, but this is at the district court level, which we'll get into some of those issues a little bit later. But that's the way they came down on this fair use defense. They slapped that down. So basically, okay, moving on to that, moving back to the CSS license, that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, Real got a license that allowed them to build DVD players and basically pull content off those DVDs for playing purposes. The only way to build a DVD player is to use the CSS license, because if you didn't use the CSS technology, it wouldn't read a standard DVD. It just wouldn't happen. So at least until, I'm assuming this is under patent, so until that expires, that's the only way to do it. And Real entered one of these licenses. So the other question was this a breach of that license? The CSS license requires the company to comply with all these technical procedures, and there was apparently, after they entered the agreement, there was this long list of tech specs that come with it. And apparently, selling a machine that makes a permanent digital copy is automatically a breach of this license. It specifically says you cannot do this. And there really wasn't much of a defense for that, because the license said it, they agreed to it, and they did it anyway, so they were kind of stuck on that. So what ended up happening is they litigated this pretty heavily, and it was very clear from the opinion which way the judge was going to go. So DVDCCA and the Motion Picture Studios ended up settling with Real for $4.5 million to cover their legal fees. I wish I got legal fees like that. I will say I don't. So Real ended up having to pay its own lawyers for 2 years worth of litigation, and then pay DVDCCA's lawyers $4.5 million, and they agreed to permanently discontinue any production on the Real DVD software or the Facet archiving machine. And that's kind of where we're sitting now, at least from the standpoint of these two parties. So there are some other issues here as far as, is this case binding in the future? How will this affect other parties? And that's really what we're concerned with, because I personally don't care too much. Does Real, you know, continue or trying to make more of these things? Can other people do them? one of your issues with this case is that this was under a preliminary injunction. Basically, you've got DVDCCA asking the court, please make them stop putting out these products until we can go through a full case. And the standard for that is there a likelihood of success on the merits? Basically, if we go all the way, the court has to say, is it likely that the person asking for the injunction is going to get it? So, and since the parties settled before a final judgment, the court never said, yes, you infringed on the DMCA, yes, you breached the license. It just said that that is likely going to happen if we take this to its logical conclusion. So there's a question over whether this ruling would actually affect other parties because it didn't go all the way to the end. But there's some very strong language, and obviously a clever lawyer wanting to apply it would say, yes, it does, and then another lawyer not wanting to apply it would say, no, it doesn't. So there's some room to argue there, but it's not necessarily set in stone. Another one of the issues is that, and just to kind of back up to really understand why this is important, you kind of have to have some idea of how the federal court system is structured. At the top, you've got your Supreme Court, which everybody's familiar with. There's one of those. Basically, its rulings are binding on itself in the future and any courts below it. Below them, you've got the circuit courts of appeals. There are 11 of them. There are 11 circuits. As an example, I practice in Mississippi. I'm in the 5th Circuit. Over here in Georgia, you guys are under the 11th Circuit. And again, if they issue a ruling, it's binding on them and the courts that are below them. So if the 9th Circuit, where California is, makes a ruling, it's binding in California, but it's not binding in Mississippi. It's considered persuasive, so the other courts can look at it and they can either decide to go with it or not. Under that, you've got your federal district courts, and there are 94 of those, and they're 1, 2, 3, I think, in every state, basically. California has 3, the southern, the central, and northern. So what's important about all that is this ruling is only binding on the Northern District of California because that was where this ruling occurred. Other courts may well find differently on these exact same issues if these issues came up again. And as I mentioned earlier, it may not be binding because it wasn't a final judgment anyway. If this issue had been appealed, the courts above it might have come down differently. And also, just as a practical matter, different jurisdictions have different political leanings, which can affect how their rulings come out. The 9th Circuit in California is considered to be the most liberal circuit, and their political leanings are going to go one way, whereas, like, I practice in the 5th, it's the most conservative jurisdiction. So typically, in my jurisdiction, if you go quoting something that the 9th Circuit did, the judges and the other attorneys are half the time going to laugh at you because they don't feel like it's precedential. Oh, those liberal hippies over there. Meanwhile, you know, if you're in the 9th Circuit and you're quoting 5th Circuit, they're probably going to say, oh, those backwoods hick gun-toting rednecks, I don't care. So so there's a real question of, you know, this may be more of an issue if the company is based in California, whereas if you brought up another company in Mississippi and tried to do this, you might get different results. So as a practical result, where are we now? DVD ripping software is everywhere. And for y'all's purposes, this court did say that you can make your own copies, and that's fine. So if you download a DVD ripping software and you make a copy of your own stuff, you haven't violated copyright law and you didn't create that software, so you're okay, so long as you're only archiving your own stuff. It's the company that put out the DVD ripping software that is potentially in trouble, and DVD ripping software is pretty widely available, and especially if you have companies in other countries that are putting these out, there's not a lot the U.S. courts can really do about it. So it's okay for consumers. It's not that big a deal. However, it will likely chill any kind of development of similar technology just because how much Real had to go through just to get to this point and then, you know, spend all this money. And, for instance, if a client came to me and asked, you know, can I make one of these archiving softwares, I would tell them it was a really bad idea just because of the way this turned out. You may win, you may lose, but you're definitely going to spend a lot of money along the way, and it's better to go somewhere else with where you're developing. Yes, sir.
Could you maybe provide some explanation as far as like why Real didn't carry through with the case to see the end result and then take it to a higher court for appeal?
Well, they could have done that. Real, and this happens in every litigation, the plaintiffs or the parties look through and they kind of test the water, seeing, okay, where do I think this is going to go? And then they look at, how much am I paying my lawyers? What is the likelihood I'm going to lose? And if I lose, what bad's going to happen? And then if you go to final judgment, after, by then it's kind of too late to settle, at least at that point. You know what your damages are going to be. Then if you want to appeal, appealing is also very expensive because you have to make all these copies of all these records and you have to post appeal bonds. So it can get exponentially more expensive the longer you go. And if you know you're going to lose, there comes a point when you have to look at it and go, okay, when do I want to staunch the bleeding? When is it just, I've paid as much as I'm going to pay, I'll do something else. And that's really, I think, where Real was. They just saw that it was only going to go downhill from here, so they just stopped it.
If they have been convicted of copyright infringement, could there be triple damages?
Potentially, yes. If there's, if you infringe on a copyright intentionally, then your damages are multiplied by a factor of 3, which could have been pretty significant with the numbers they were putting out here. But on the other hand, it likely wouldn't have been quite as bad just because this happened right as the products were hitting the shelves. So not much had actually gotten out yet. So that issue, I'm sure, was in play. Honestly, I'm not sure how treble damages work for this particular provision. Usually when I'm dealing with it, it's in terms of blatant infringement. These guys didn't actually infringe anything in particular. They were circumventing encryption technology. So it may or may not have applied. I'd really have to look more at, I would have had to been involved in the process to really say. But if that answers your question.
Well, that would go into weighing whether
they... Right, absolutely. And if that was about to come in, that would be a very good reason to go on and settle and be done with it.
Yeah, my question is, goes back to what you were saying about the impact of this ruling. You had said that the ninth district where this was decided was one of the more liberal districts. I'm not really sure what you meant by that, but I'm assuming that my definition of liberal, that if the court in this case was clearly leaning to favor of the companies and not in favor of me copying my DVDs, that it's not looking real hopeful for no matter where this case comes up.
Well, and liberal is a very fluid term, as you mentioned. I'm sure everybody's aware. I mean, when I say liberal, I'm referring to basically Democrat. And when I say conservative, I'm really referring more to Republican. So, and things don't always break along those lines. It's not always quite that clear, but when I was making that statement, basically what I mean is that certain circuits don't respect other circuits as much as maybe they should for whatever reason, and it just means that those issues are in play. But I would say it doesn't look real good for if you were a developer wanting to create a software doing this. Like I said, the bright spot is it doesn't really seem to hurt consumers. Other than it just takes away your ability to get access to these products, but since the products are really out there, you're probably not out that much. So, other questions? Yes, sir.
There was a device I had heard of a little while back called Kaleidoscope.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what became of that, and where in time was this relative to this decision? Where are you based out of in Mississippi?
Okay, taking the easy one first, I'm based out of Jackson, capital city. That's where most of the lawyers hang out there in Gulfport on the Biloxi on the Gulf Coast. But as far as Kaleidoscope, yeah, those issues were in play. And what happened in the Kaleidoscope case, as I recall, Kaleidoscope put out a similar product that did archiving, and they... there was a question under California state contract law of whether all the contract's terms were binding. Basically, the way all these contracts were entered into, the initial companies would sign a basic agreement, and then later these tech specs would come over. And the question was Kaleidoscope bound by these tech specs because they weren't issued until after the signatures were on the page? And the California state court at the lower level ruled that no, they were not, because as a matter of California contract law, everything has to be in the contract before the signatures are on the dotted line. So That actually, Kaleidoscope was the basis for Real doing this. And they even said so, I read in some trial testimony, that Real looked at that Kaleidoscope case and said, you know what that means, it's okay, we're going to go for it. So that was kind of going on in the background through all this. And I've read that since then, the California Court of Appeals actually overturned that. So I believe that Kaleidoscope actually ended up in the same spot at the end of the day.
And the cause of this is the DMCA.
There are a couple of causes. You've got that CSS license out there, so they're just breach of contract issues. The DMCA is probably the bigger culprit, but you know that's the bigger issue you're running into. But it's the fact that every company that's doing a DVD player has signed on to this license. So that contract is going to necessarily apply unless somebody is just went off and did their own version of a software that was cracking CSS, which would fall under the DMCA, and you would just have DMCA issues. But both those issues are kind of work in tandem with any major corporation that's trying to do right. Okay. Had another question over here.
Who?
There.
Oh, sorry. I guess my question sort of evolves around the pivot of First Amendment free speech mm-hmm. guarantees. Like, did they primarily get in trouble because they were trying to sell the software? Like, for example, what if they were to release the source code in a document and just post that available? Would that have made any difference at all?
That probably wouldn't have made any difference. First Amendment doesn't really come into it. Because we're dealing with the copyright laws, basically what their infringement, as far as the court was concerned, was because they were making the product available. And if they had made the source code available even for free, they still would have been liable. Now, there are questions as to damages, because typically profits are one measure of how much you have to pay if you get popped for it. So if you were releasing it for free, your damages wouldn't be nearly as high. So that is an issue. But again, like I said, these guys really hadn't even released much before all this happened. I think the suits actually were dropped on the day of the release of Facet. And Real DVD, I want to say, had been out a little while, but not long. And they've since obviously been pulled off the market, but there are probably some copies kind of floating around somewhere. But, yes, sir.
As far as those copies, I did the trial version when it first came out. I got the notice from Real and stuff. Mm-hmm. I did the trial, but I did not do the purchase. If I had done it at that time, would that copy still work, or did they have to refund people and remove the licenses? Or
I'm not sure, but I suspect that copy would still work unless they took any affirmative action to cause it to not work. And I don't know that they did that. I think they just stopped distributing it. So most likely, if you had bought it in time, you would still have and still be able to use it. It's just that you won't be able to get a copy now unless you find it online somewhere.
Another question.
Okay.
I was kind of interested in what you said about having, basically, you can't make a DVD player without getting this license.
And right.
I guess going back a bit, I'm a little surprised that there wasn't some more resistance, especially among some of the cheaper manufacturers of DVDs, in terms mm-hmm. of resisting, you know, kind of being forced to sign on to this license. And was there any, just out of curiosity, was there any resistance?
Not that I know of. Basically, the issue you've got is that if you try to build a machine that goes around CSS technology and plays the DVD anyway, then you've committed a violation under the DMCA. So you use kind of a copyright issue. And so as long as that technology is under patent or whatever IP rights are protecting it, and you potentially have some infringement issues there, so the only thing you can really do to keep from getting popped by the IP laws is by signing on to this license. It's kind of monopolistic, and actually one of the procedural wranglings that came up in this case that I didn't really get into is the Real actually filed in California, or as part of the suit, saying that the DVD CCA was basically a monopoly. I think it was like some kind of racketeering, something or other, which the court shot down. But they made that argument, was that this is unfair, that they have this right to pretty much lock down the industry. But the court pretty much said, don't care. And as a practical matter, antitrust laws are not strictly enforced like they used to be. That was a really big deal back in the 30s. But they're only very lightly enforced at this point anyway. So it kind of stinks, but that's all your DVD manufacturers are really, they are stuck with this license. Have any other questions? Yes, sir. Up front.
I guess, to your knowledge, under copyright law, mm-hmm. you know, let's say I can, if I know how to do it, I can legally duplicate my DVD.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, let's say I destroy my DVD.
Mm-hmm.
Are the manufacturers required in any way to give me a reduced price copy so I can then use my license?
Nope.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, I mean, this setup is definitely built to favor the copyright owners over consumers, and it pretty much puts you in a position of having to rebuy stuff if it breaks, and it's very, you know, it's fighting against the trend of going digital, which I think is ultimately a losing battle, because people are going to do it anyway. And they're trying to hold off on that as long as they can. And part of that, just as a backup issue, is the Motion Picture Association, as well as the record industry and a lot of the people who are putting out entertainment content, are very concerned about piracy, and they're seeing their sales drop. Now, whether that's due to piracy or whether that's due to just a change in consumer habits is very open to debate. But that's kind of working in the background, and they're terrified, and they're just kind of grasping at straws, and this is one of their attempts to do that. I think ultimately things are going to go digital whether they like it or not.
Well, we actually, to address the question that was just asked, mm-hmm. if I buy a book and I decide I'm going to build my own little photocopier and make a copy of the book for my own personal use, which under Title 17 I can do, and my photocopier causes my book to catch on fire, the publisher has no responsibility whatsoever to provide me another book.
Right.
And we wouldn't think twice about that. We'd say, oh, I set it on fire. Bummer.
Gotta buy another book.
So if you happen to actually accidentally destroy your DVD in the process of making a copy, oh well, you know.
I'm just saying, you know, you get a scratch on the thing, you can't use the thing anymore. You were basically forbidden, technically.
You get a scratch on the thing, you can't use the thing anymore. You're basically technically forbidden to make a copy because it's illegal to discuss copy, you know. It's questionable, you know, can I talk about this copying software with anyone because, oh, they might come and get me. You know, the issue really came up with games because, you know,
right.
They put kids' games on DVDs in weird formats and then, mm-hmm. oh, gee, kid's going to scratch it.
Yep.
Sooner or later. Or, you know, little brother might bite it. And then how do you get to use your license? Because you bought the license, not the media. But
this
what they're
true.
Trying to say is, oh, the license is worth nothing. The media is worth everything. But wait, the license is worth everything too. And
yeah, and I think you end up kind of, yeah, and I agree with you. It's one-sided, and I think part of it is the DMCA has some serious issues, and Congress has become bad of late of just passing stuff without reading it and really understanding it. And to a certain extent, I can understand because they can't be experts on everything, but this one is one that I think, especially in light of this ruling, they should seriously consider giving some extra guidance to the court system on how to make legitimate archive copies, because it's clear from the wording that you can do that. And I think this result shows that something's wrong with the legislation. And that's basically what the court was saying as well, is they're saying, you know, I'm bound by this legislation, this is the result, and, you know, until Congress fixes it, this is where we're going to be. And that is a logically consistent way to go, even though I don't particularly care for the result that the court came to.
The Library of Congress is given the authority to make exceptions to the DMCA, I think, every 3 years. And they recently made some exceptions, and I believe one of them was the right to make a copy and you're not in violation of the DMCA. Is that correct?
I'm not sure. I know that Library of Congress does have the authority to do that, and I know they do regularly. I'm not sure what the most recent changes are offhand, but that wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, it came out like a week ago, so
okay.
I just read it. So
okay.
I don't remember the details.
And that would, if that's what they did, that would, again, support this ruling that, yeah, you can make your own personal archive copies, but it wouldn't say anything as to companies like Real and their ability to make copies.
Well, going back... Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
There's one of the original DMCA cases, and it might have been the actual first one, was a researcher, a foreign researcher who does cryptographic research, who was looking at the algorithm used by CSS, and said, wow, this is a really bad algorithm, and here's why. And came to a conference in the United States. I wish I could remember his name. Are you familiar with the case?
Not offhand.
He came to the United States and was arrested. And he didn't get to present at the conference. It was a big to-do over this. And he was an academic-type researcher. He wasn't trying to to rip off DVDs or make copies or anything. He was just saying, wow, what really bad cryptography this is. well... As a result of that, essentially it was, if you were not allowed to own or distribute the tools that allow you to crack the protection mechanism, which meant even if you read his paper off a foreign website and wrote the code yourself, you would be in violation uh-huh. of the DMCA, and you don't even own a DVD because
right.
you wrote the code. Has that changed?
I would argue that, at least based on this ruling, the court might be backing down on that, although it may be just one of those practical issues that the cat's out of the bag and it's really too late to do anything about it anyway, so why not protect the consumers? And that may have been in play as well. I think both those are potentially valid issues, so it's going to depend on your jurisdiction, honestly. Yes, sir.
Okay, if you, as I understand this, if you were to download software which came from another country and used it to crack your DVD for personal use, that would be legal.
According to this court, yes.
However, at the beginning of every DVD, there's the DMCA warning that you're liable for $25,000 per DVD that you crack even for personal use. So isn't that a contradiction?
Well, it probably is, and as a practical matter, it's a warning. It doesn't have any legal significance other than they just want to throw it in your face. The law is what it is, and they can say about it whatever they want to. It's not an agreement. You don't agree to it by playing the DVD. So, and it's not couched in those terms. It really doesn't count as anything, honestly. It's just it's strictly a warning thing. And I mean, and as a practical matter, a lot of companies do stuff like that. They'll throw things in there that are not really enforceable, but they know that the average person doesn't know any different, and if it scares them into compliance, then all the better for them.
So similar to the police coming to your house for a noise complaint, and they say, by our procedures, we're supposed to check out the premises to make sure everything's okay. We're going to go in the house checking out. Is it okay? And the answer is, no, I do not consent to a search.
Absolutely. And that is always the right answer.
Yeah, we had this session last night. For those who missed it, you should have been here. It was all about busted and how you should interact with the police.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, in my experience, people who are actively committing crimes know better. People who are generally, you know, law-abiding citizens don't. So really, the only people that ends up hurting are people who are trying to do the right thing in most cases. But, you know, that is what it is. But, do you have a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to review the use of fair use for educational
mm-hmm.
purposes, because
mm-hmm.
I know that's a whole other category. Like, since I am a teacher, if I want to show, you know, sometimes I don't want to bring the DVD to school.
Mm-hmm.
I might want to record it on my computer and just
right.
show it. Right. Especially so. How does that play out in terms of fair use?
Okay. In terms of fair use, well, okay. So you're archiving. This court specifically addressed personal use. They
right.
didn't address educational. That would be under that Copyright Office exclusions that we were talking about earlier. I think educational use was one of those exclusions that was put in almost initially. So I think you'd still be okay for educational use.
Also, the copyright owners look really bad in the press when they beat up on schools.
Yes. So as a practical matter, you're not going to get sued on that, so it's okay. And it's all a matter of dollars at the end of the day. They're going to go after the big fish. It's not worth spending $4.5 million on lawyers to come after you. So as long as you're not making a whole bunch of money off something, and if you're doing it for free, you're probably not going to get sued unless it's really notorious and they really have a chip on their shoulder. Yes, sir.
Yeah, the other question I had, software, you know, software companies, typically you destroy the media, you know, you prove that you had it in the first place, they'll give you a new one.
Right.
That is that required under law? Is that just their contract, them just being nice?
I think that's really them just being nice. I don't think they're required to do that. I suspect that software manufacturers, especially game developers, are a little bit more lenient on that because they have a little different business model. I've got some friends that work in that industry, and from everything I've been told, they work on the idea that they're going to make all the money they're going to make on a game in the first 3 months. And it's going to be a success or a failure in those 3 months, and anything after that is just gravy. So they're not worried about really enforcing the IP after they release it unless it's a series issue. And they'll generally put it out, and then they're on to the next thing. So they're a lot looser about this stuff, whereas Disney's still fighting over, you know, extending Walt Disney's copyrights after he's been dead for 50-plus years. So it's just a different mindset, I think.
Okay. I mean, would it be possible for Congress to enact a law and say, all right, if you want to lock this stuff up like this, you must, if a consumer can provide pieces of a busted DVD or scratch it one to any store that sold it, they just have to give them a new one, and, you know, you're out maybe for 50 cents, a nominal charge, something like that.
Right. I think it would absolutely be within Congress' power to do that. Congress has a lot of discretion on what they can pass as far as laws. The issue with that is that usually Congress tend to move toward wherever the lobbyists are leading them, and there's not as much interest in paying money to protect consumer rights as there are interest in paying money to protect business rights. So that's much less likely to happen just as a practical matter because of the way our system's set up. Other questions? Comments? Okay, well, I appreciate y'all coming, and I guess have a good rest of the day, and hope you had fun. And I guess feel free to come back to any of the other EFF track stuff, because we'll be here.
Thank you.